Discourse on Habeas Corpus by Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom. Episode 6. Habeas Corpus, Application, Law, and Effective Legislation Continued. In the last episode, we discussed two cases, both out of Wisconsin and with the blessings of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where they challenged and wanted to release both Tarbell and Booth, the people restrained, but they found out that there was a constitutional nexus. There was authority within the Constitution that extended the authority of the federal government into the case of fugitive slaves and or military. Now, this gets us into a rather interesting period of our history, the Civil War, in the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. We're going to go to one now that demonstrates that absent specific authority in the Constitution, that laws passed by Congress are invalid. And this was based upon the 15th Amendment, which was ratified in 1870, and says, the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Section 2 gives Congress the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So, one, we've got a statement of what it's to do, and two, gives Congress the power to enforce this article by legislation. The case, however, is United States versus Reese, R-E-E-S-E, and it's 92 U.S. 214. That's 92 U.S. 214, and it was heard in 1875, 5 years after the enactment of the 15th, or ratification of the 15th Amendment. Now, what happened, some commissioners of election had failed to provide all assistance to some black people that wanted to vote. They were charged by the Federal Elections Commission and taken, charged with crimes under the legislation that was enacted by Congress under authority based on the 15th Amendment. And there were two provisions in that enactment, sections 3 and 4, which came into question. So we're going to deal with sections 3 and 4, and we'll see what happens when there's not specific authority for the legislation that was enacted. Section 3 says, in part, that whenever any act is or shall be required to be done by any citizen as a prerequisite to qualify or entitle him to vote, if it fail to be carried into execution by reason of the wrongful act or omission of the person or officer charged with the duty of receiving or permitting such performance or offer to perform or acting thereon, and the person so offering and failing as aforesaid and being otherwise qualified shall be entitled to vote in the same manner and to the same extent as if he had in fact performed such act. Now the problem with this is it says that any act. It doesn't say any person denied because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. What they said in the decision is the third section does not in express terms limit the offense of an inspector of elections for which the punishment is provided to a wrongful discrimination on account of race. So it was too broadly written. He continues, the statute contemplates a most important change in the election laws. Previous to its adoption, the states, as a general rule, regulated in their own way all the details of all elections. So these people continued as usual. They weren't responsible, even though this guy wasn't allowed to vote, because the section was under Section 3 because it was too broad. Now, Section 4 of the legislation, congressional legislation, says that if any person by force, bribery, threats or intimidation or other unlawful means shall hinder, delay, prevent or obstruct or shall combine and confederate with others to hinder, delay, prevent or obstruct any citizen from doing any act required to be done to qualify him to vote or from voting at any election as aforesaid, such person shall, and then it goes on to list the penalties. Now, again, here's what the court said. We find there are no words of limitation or reference even that can be construed as manifesting any intention to confine its provisions to the terms of the 15th Amendment. That section has for its object the punishment of all persons who by force, bribery, etc., hinder, delay, etc., any person from qualifying or voting. In view of all these facts, we feel compelled to say that, in our opinion, the language of the third and fourth section does not confine their operation to unlawful discrimination on account of race, etc. If Congress had the power to provide generally for the punishment of those who unlawfully interfered to prevent the exercise of elective franchise without regard to such discrimination, the language of these sections would be broad enough for that purpose. But Congress didn't have that authority because the amendment only mentioned the three conditions and the legislation went beyond that. Now, that's a fine line. But they can't go beyond what the Constitution, in this case, the 15th Amendment, specifically authorized them to do. They went beyond it. So these guys are let free, and the court said Section 3 and 4 were unlawful. If any law is unconstitutional, then it is no law. So that's what happens when there's not a constitutional nexus. There was no nexus, so the court said these two, sections 3 and 4, are no good. Or as Marshall said, they're void. They're repugnant to the Constitution, they're void. Now this next case doesn't have to do with nexus, the constitutional nexus or absence of nexus. It has to do with jurisdiction. And earlier we talked about the spheres. Each has a sphere of influence. And you can't come in mine and I can't go in yours, so to speak. This was a case, a fellow named Charles Mason Lane was tried for a crime that occurred in the Oklahoma Territory or Indian Territory. The trial was held in the District Court of the United States in and for the District of Kansas, but it happened in the Oklahoma Territory. Now, the Oklahoma Territory was just a territory. It was owned by the United States and not Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, exclusive legislative jurisdiction, but actually in Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, where it says the Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needed rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. So this territory, now, under the Northwest Ordinances, a territory, when it gets to a certain population, can begin to establish a government. They can have an executive, legislative, and judicial, but then they have to prepare and have the Constitution accepted by Congress, and then they enter the Union. So there's a transition period where the three bodies of government exist, and so this will be discussing that circumstance. So Lane... The crime was rape of somebody under 16 years of age, but it occurred in Oklahoma Territory, which had no government except the federal government under Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2. The charge was, on or about the fourth day of July in the year of our Lord, 1889, at that part of the district of... This is judicial district, Kansas aforesaid, the same being a place and district of country under the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States and within the exclusive jurisdiction of this court, with force of arms in and upon one Francis M. Skeet, a female under the age of 16, then and there being violently and feloniously did make an assault on her, that said Francis M. Skeed, then and there, forcibly and against her will, feloniously did ravish and carnally know her, Skeed. So he raped her in an area that was not within Kansas, but was within the Kansas Judicial District. And that was the assignment of districts by the federal government. The case, by the way, is N. Reed Lane. It's 135 U.S. 443, and it was heard in 1890. Justice Miller gave the decision of the court, and he said, the act of Congress approved February 9, 1889, under which defendant is indicted and convicted, it is provided that every person who shall carnally and unlawfully know any female under the age of 16 years, or who shall be accessory to such carnal and unlawful knowledge before the fact, in the District of Columbia, or other place, except the territories over which the United States has exclusive jurisdiction, or on any vessel within the admiralty or maritime jurisdiction of the United States and out of the jurisdiction of any state or territory, shall be guilty of a felony, and when convicted thereof shall be punished by imprisonment at hard labor for the first offense for not more than 15 years, and for each subsequent offense not more than 30 years. So the distinction said District of Columbia or other place, except in the states or territories that, well, he'll get into that a little more clearly later. We think the words except the territories have reference exclusively to that system of organized government long existing within the United States by which certain regions of country have been erected into civil government. These governments have an executive, a legislative, and a judicial system. They have the powers which all these departments of government have exercised, which are conferred upon them by the Act of Congress. And their legislative acts are subject to the disapproval of the Congress of the United States. They are not in any sense independent governments, yet they exercise nearly all the powers of government under what are generally called organic acts passed by the Congress conferring such power on them. It is this class of government, long known by the name of territories, that the Act of Congress accepts from the operation of the statute, while it extends to all other places over which the United States has exclusive jurisdiction. Oklahoma was not of this class of territories. It, Oklahoma Territory, had no legislative body, it had no government, it had no established organic system of government for the control of people within its limits, or the territories of the United States have and have always had. Now, let me step back just a bit. Lane was challenging this because the punishment under the federal statute, the 15 years of imprisonment, far exceeded what would have been true in Kansas. So if he were charged under Kansas law, the punishment would have been much less or perhaps no crime at all. But it was federal, and that's where the rub came in. So we've got three different entities here. We've got the states, who have legislative, executive, and judicial branches. We have territories in transition that have executive, legislative, and judicial branches. Had the crime occurred in either of those, it would not be a federal matter because they were lacking jurisdiction. They had, in the case of the states, made them states of the union. In the case of the territories with the three elements of government, they had granted them the authority to exercise their civil government under those three branches that were established as part of that territory. And so the jurisdiction of the federal government, except forts, magazines, arsenals, other needful buildings, etc., extended only to other land owned by the United States and wherein they had exclusive jurisdiction under the provisions of Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2. So Lane lost because he fell in that third element, that territory without a civil government. So now we're beginning to get a broader picture. Not only do the laws have to be constitutional, they have to be exercised when jurisdiction exists that authorizes the exercise of that those laws. And now we've got two cases. We've got this act that made rape in the territories criminal, that set the distinction of jurisdiction to those areas without the civil governments. And then we also had the Act of 1825 that was mentioned earlier, wherein the land had to be ceded and the jurisdiction had to be ceded. So we're getting a picture now of both subject matter jurisdiction, you know, there has to be authority to enact the law, and venue jurisdiction, or geographic jurisdiction where there has to be jurisdiction over the parties, over the land where the act or crime is committed.